part two. I hope that it will be interesting for you people listen to it. It's not great, but it's something. On February 16, 1943, I was shot down over Saint-Nazaire, France. This was the 10th raid for me, and the fourth time we had bombed the submarine pens in Saint-Nazaire. We left our base at Shelveston, England, early in the morning, and rendezvoused with other planes at Land's End. We waited for other groups to join us, and then we flew close to the water until we were opposite Saint-Nazaire. We then climbed to 26,000 feet, dropped our bombs on the target, and headed home, overland. We were attacked immediately by fighters after dropping the bombs. However, on our bomb run, the flak was very thick. Fighters made two passes at us, and on the second pass, which came from 1 o'clock, the engine on the right side of the plane, inboard, was hit. It started to burn fiercely, and someone hit the emergency signal to bail out. At that point, I worked very hard to open the escape hatch. Came off with some difficulty, and I looked down at the ground, which was about 16,000 feet away. I just couldn't jump at that time, but suddenly the plane turned over and threw me back. Now, instead of dropping out of the plane, I had to struggle to get up and pull myself up to get out. Luckily, I was able to pull myself up through the door and out of the plane. I fell for some distance before I pulled the ripcord. I watched the plane spin down crazily, with flames trailing it all the way. There were no other chutes. I was the only one who managed to get out. As I fell, the thought ran through my head that for me the war was over. Far from it. I landed in a clearing that had been plowed recently, and as I was taking off my parachute, I saw an elderly Frenchman sitting against a tree. I told him in my poor French who I was, and at the same time, I tried to cover my chute in the woods. The man didn't understand me, but not too far away, I saw a farmhouse. I went into the house, in which there were two old women. They knew immediately who I was, and I told them that I wanted to change clothes. They gave me a shirt, jacket, shoes, and pants. I gave them a couple hundred francs, which I had in the escape kit. The escape kit contained 2,000 francs, a hacksaw, a compass, a map, chewing gum, chocolate bar, and some benzodrine tablets. While I was changing clothes, two young girls came into the house. They had seen me coming down in the chute. Each had a bicycle, and one offered to lend me hers so that I could get out of the area fast. The other girl and I started down the road, but I discovered that my bike had a flat tire. The girl and I walked together with the bikes, and as we were doing so, truckload of Germans passed us going toward the plane. We walked to a small town called Miesalac, where the flat was fixed. We rode a considerable distance before the girl indicated that this was as far as she could go with the bikes. We left them at a farmhouse, and she walked with me until dusk. At that time, she indicated that she had to go back to the farmhouse. I was now on my own. It was getting dark fast. I was hungry. I had to find a place to sleep. I stopped at several houses, but no one wanted to have anything to do with me. Finally, I stopped at a barn in which several men were milking cows. I watched them do their work. They saw me, but no one said anything. There was a farmhouse a short distance away, so I decided to go there. An elderly woman came to the door and invited me in when I told her that I was an American, an aviator. "Will you help me?" I said. She invited me to sit down and gave me a large bowl of stew. The room was large with a fireplace, a large table with several chairs, and bunk beds lining the walls. The men came in and acknowledged me as if they had done this before. I told them about my parachuting down. I offered them a cigarette, and one of them remarked that it was a cigarette for women. I knew what he meant when I tried smoking one of their Galois. Their cigarettes were as strong as cigars. I was taken out to the barn and slept in the hayloft. I spent a very uncomfortable night. My neck was sore and bleeding from the blow the metal buckle from the chute caused. But I was safe. The next morning they gave me some bread and butter and milk for breakfast. They also gave me a piece of bread and some cheese and invited me to continue my trip. I thanked them profusely and went on my way down the road. It was a beautiful day. At first, when I heard a car coming, I would hide in the bushes. But so many cars came, I wasted a lot of time hiding. I decided to ignore them, and they ignored me. Remember, most of these vehicles carry Germans. I approached the river, and there at the approach to the bridge crossing the river was a German guard. I didn't know what to do. Before he could see me, I ducked into the woods alongside the river, hoping I could get a boat to cross. My better judgment told me that I was daydreaming if I expected to find a boat and then cross that wide river. I returned to the road and walked a limp across the bridge, passing within a few feet of the German. I did not dare look at him. I walked very slowly with my head down and limped across the bridge. On the other side of the bridge was a church. I went into the church to see if I could get some help from the priest, but it was as empty and cold as a tomb. It was a beautiful day, and I walked miles through some towns that were teeming with Germans, but no one paid any attention to me. Dusk came. I started looking for food and or a place to sleep. No one wanted to help me. At one place alongside the road, I forced my way inside the house and demanded food. I got two uncooked eggs, which I drank without difficulty, having had raw eggs when I was a child. It was dark when I came to a cafe at a crossroad. Outside the cafe, there were several bikes. I went in and ordered wine. I had a little book with French and English expressions. While I was sitting drinking the wine, I noticed that the lady who served me came out of a kitchen. I hadn't finished my wine and decided to steal one of the bikes and take off. When I got outside, it was dark. Then my good sense returned and told me it would be foolish to steal a bike. As soon as I was discovered stolen, the police would be looking for me. No one was looking for me. Now, no one was looking for me. I went back into the cafe and finished my wine. In the book, with the French and English expressions, there's an expression, "Do you have a room free for tonight? Avez-vous une chambre libre?" I approached the lady at the door of the kitchen and used this expression. She said that she didn't, and then it was that I told her that I was an American aviator. She immediately took my arm and pulled me into the kitchen. She closed the door and asked me if I weren't hungry. I tried to tell her in my poor high school French what had happened to me. She accepted the fact that I was escaping and indicated she would help. Two little children were playing on the floor. They were delighted when I gave them the chewing gum, which I had. My husband came home from work, and we had a stilted conversation in French, English, and pantomime. I told them where I would like to go, which was Nantes, and they assured me they could get me there. The next morning, a man came in a car and took me to Nantes to meet a man who spoke English. We met him in a cafe, but his English was worse than my French. He took me to his home, which was an apartment over a motorcycle shop. He lived here with his wife and mother. The mother was an extremely elderly woman who was scared to death. She was afraid of what would happen to them if the Germans discovered they were hiding in America. After spending several days there, a woman came who spoke very good English. Plans were made for me to ride on a train to Bordeaux. At Bordeaux, the engineer would put me up for the night, and I would go to Montauban. From Montauban, I would go directly into Spain. I was to ride in Spain as a fireman on the locomotive. At the end of the run, I would walk 2 kilometers to a place where the Spanish police would arrest me. They would keep me in prison for a short time, then send me to Gibraltar. Once in Gibraltar, the British would send me back to England. It sounded great, but I was taken to the railroad station, and I was introduced to the engineer. When we got to Bordeaux, he would meet me. I got on a third-class passenger compartment car, which seated six or eight people. Several people rode in the car with me, but no one bothered me. I played that I was deaf and dumb. No easy matter for several hours. I got off the train at Bordeaux and waited for the engineer to meet me. While I was on the platform, the train pulled away. There I was, all alone, with no engineer. And out of nowhere, he appeared and took me to a small place in the railroad yards where the men stayed overnight. The next morning, I was taken out to the yards. It was dark, but there was an engine standing all alone, getting up steam. As we approached the locomotive, a man came out from under the engine and motioned for me to get down between the wheels. I objected, but he showed me that there was a small area under the engine into which a person could hide. Boards were placed covering this hole. I was to stay in this hiding place until someone would come tapping on the boards. The space was cramped, but not too bad. The train started and stopped many times. I could hear footsteps crunching around the engine at all the stops. Finally, at about noon, the signal for me to come out was tapped on the boards. I was covered with coal dust, but still free and on my way to Spain. This place was called Montalbán. The reason why I had to be hidden was that the country had been divided into occupied and unoccupied France. The people in the north could not enter unoccupied France without permission and papers. Therefore, many Frenchmen sneaked into the south of France in any way they could. From Montauban, arrangements were to be made for me to go directly into Spain. While waiting for the arrangements to be made, several men came into the room to see the American who was escaping. Unfortunately, a traitor reported my presence to the police or a collaborator, and I had to be taken out of there immediately. I was placed on an electric locomotive which took me to Toulouse. At the station, the chief of the engineers met me and took me to his home. It was a modest house, so simple I can't recall anything about the place. He lived here with his wife and diabetic son. The boy was a sickly teenager. They treated me very well, taking me sightseeing about the city, pointing out military installations and other points of interest. One day a young man and woman came into the house and talked to my hosts in French at great length until a lady turned to me and said, "Good old American, where are you from in the States?" I said, "I'm from New York. Where are you from?" She said, "Chicago." She and her husband had been working with the French underground, making contacts for escaping Americans and Frenchmen. While I was with these people, an Australian and a Scotchman came in. They were flying for the British at night and had been shot down. A couple of days later, two Frenchmen came in. They had escaped from prison. Six of us ate and slept in the same room. I should say five of us. It was uncomfortable, but we were still free. One day a man came to the house to inform the lady that her husband had been picked up by the Gestapo and was being held for questioning. After being told this disturbing news, the Frenchmen bolted out of the back door and were gone. Pete, Jerry, and I decided to stay together and let the underground take care of us. Late that night, a man and woman came to take us to another location. We were taken to a large apartment house, but it was an experience getting there. We had to dodge police patrols because there was a curfew. I remember entering an apartment, and there, seated at a table, was an old lady rolling out cigarettes. I asked her for one, and she scornfully said, I guess she said this. She indicated I should make my own, which I did. We stayed there for a short time. Then these two people, the man and woman who had taken us to this place, took us out of the apartment. And again, remember, we had to dodge patrols. We went to the railroad station. As we entered the railroad station, I noticed there were a lot of people inside. We had to sit down wherever we could. I sat at one end of the lobby, if you want to call it that. Pete and Jerry to the exit door. And the man and woman who took us to the place sat in the middle of the station. The place was jammed. This is about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. While we were waiting, a gendarme and a plainclothesman came in and started circulating around the station asking people for their identification papers. Of course, none of us had any identification, and what they were doing was taking out the people who did not have proper identification. Just before they got to me, the man and woman in the middle of the floor, people who had taken us there, got up and went toward another door, which was apparently the place to go to in order to get to the train. Pete and Jerry were sound asleep. I had to go over and give them both a kick. We got outside on the platform. Train came in. We got on, got into an apartment compartment, and we changed trains several times during the night. I remember saying to the fellas, because I still had my compass with me, I thought we were going toward Spain, but we weren't. We were going north. We discovered later that the town to which we had been taken was called Bergerac. At Bergerac, we were taken out to a farmhouse. There was an elderly French major from World War I, a man and a woman, and a young fellow who was trying to avoid being conscripted by the Germans. We spent several days there, very comfortable. The man took our pictures, and of course what he was trying to do is make contact for us so that we could get papers and get on our way to Spain. One day the same thing happened to him. He disappeared, never showed up. The old Frenchman took us to an abandoned house out in the woods and told us to reste ici. Yeah, this is a cold night, February. No, it wasn't February. It was March. Now it's March the 12th. Because I'll never forget March 13th. We spent the night there. March 13th came, bright and clear. We decided to take a walk out into the countryside. Came to an open field, and the sun was shining, and it was so warm. We had been cold the night before. And so we stayed there. We stayed out in the sun. And I fell asleep. I don't know how long I was asleep. I could hear a plane buzzing around. Little do we know that there were probably Germans and spotted us. At any rate, went back to the farmhouse, abandoned farmhouse, and we had started the fire. And of course, that we shouldn't have done. It was stupid. Here we are out in an abandoned house, and suddenly smoke appears. Somebody spotted it. And at least the old major did and came and gave us hell. He told us, put it out, and then he disappeared. Later that night, a stranger came banging on the door of this abandoned house and told us that the gendarmes were coming for us. Well, we had to take him at his word, and he said he would take care of us. He took us to an abandoned, well, it wasn't abandoned, we were abandoned. He took us to a cemetery and told us to wait there for him to return. Well, there wasn't much we could do. It was a bright moonlight night. It was a beautiful night. He came back with a man, and they jabbered back and forth, deciding what to do. They had brought some food with them, by the way. I can remember sitting down with my back against a tombstone, eating a chicken head. I don't remember the last time I had a chicken head. I don't know whether I ever had one before then or not, but it tasted good. So the man who had discovered us first led us out of the cemetery, and we came to a spot where he and the other man didn't know what to do. And finally the fellow who discovered us, or found us earlier, said he would go ahead, and if it was safe, he would whistle. He hadn't been gone in a very, very long time when the other guy who was with us said L.A., which indicated he wanted us to go along. I said, I didn't hear any whistle. Pas de souffle. Ah, oui, he said. Okay. So we started down the road. Remember, bright moonlight night, and we came to a spot where there were trees on both sides of the road. And it was very dark in this area. We walked into the middle of it, and we were immediately surrounded by six gendarmes. Of course, we couldn't go any further with these guys pointing their guns at us. It took us to a farmhouse nearby, and the farmhouse happened to be the farmhouse of the man who was with us. I think we got him off. They questioned us at great length in their poor English and our poor French, responding that this man had nothing whatsoever to do with our escape. We had just met him on the road. I think they bought that because eventually they took us out, handcuffed the three of us together, marched us out, and left the man at the farmhouse. Took us to a little town called La Force. There the chief of police is sitting with his little notebook in front of him, and he's asking us for information about what our bomb load was, what our target was, what kind of planes we flew. And of course we said, all we can give you is our name, rank, and serial number. And he closed his book and said, okay, I will not write this down. You can tell me now. Well, I don't know if it was Pete or Jerry, said, what's the matter with you? If we tell you this, when we leave, you're just going to write it down. And of course, the man was very angry. And he told us that his family had been bombed, and somebody in his family had been killed by Americans, by the American bomb. Well, there wasn't much we could do about that. Well, we were put in a terrible cell. It was dirty, and it hadn't been used, I guess, for years. It was really rank. Didn't sleep much that night. Took us to the railroad station next day with three gendarmes covering us. We were all handcuffed together. And we were taken to Limoges. That's a large city where we were placed in an awful cell. It was only wide enough for the three of us to, I guess you might say, lie down. But they had boards at an angle about 45 degrees in the cell. No window, just a big massive iron door. No light. Well, there was a light, but they didn't have it on. We spent several days there, nights there, waiting for God knows what. And the food that we had was bought by with our own money. Frenchman didn't provide this. Luckily, so I had the 2,000 francs less all this money I'd given away. And I think it was the third day, one of the fellows was taken out, didn't come back. And then the other guy was taken out, he didn't come back. Finally, I was taken out, and I was taken to a detective headquarters. There, they took a picture of my head, measured my head, took my fingerprints, and started asking me all kinds of questions about how I got to where I was, and the bombing material. They had no business asking me. So finally I said to this Frenchman, by the way, he looked like Peter Lorre. I said, what are you doing? He said, here we come over here to try to help you get away or free you from the Germans, and you do this to us. And this little devil said, monsieur, nous sommes obligés arrêtez-vous. I interpret that as we are obliged to arrest you. Well, I called him all kinds of choice English expletives, and he finally let me go. I was taken back to the cell, and there were the other two fellows, and they had been questioned too. Well, of course, they had given the Gestapo, not the Gestapo, the Frenchman, any information either. I learned later that Pete Jerry flew in the same plane for the British and had been dropping spies and saboteurs. If the Germans or the collaborators knew that that's what they were doing, they wouldn't have been long for this world. They never told me. Good thing they didn't. I don't think I would have divulged it anyway, but I'm glad they hadn't. Taken back to the cell. Next morning, we're put on a train, again handcuffed, and taken to a little town called Castres. Castres is east of Toulouse. Here, it was solitary confinement. And I can tell you that those first few weeks were awful. The cell had nothing in it, nothing of any interest. It was an old blanket on the floor, a bucket, a bottle, about a quart bottle, I guess it was, and a cup, and a tin can. The tin can was used for food, a spoon. In the middle of the day, we got big meal, big deal. It was awful. In the morning, got some coffee and a little bit of wine and a piece of bread. That was the extent of the food for all the time I was there. Once a day, they'd take me down to a courtyard. There were many courtyards, and each time I was taken out, it was a different courtyard. This was for exercise. Promenade, fair promenade, they call it. I never saw Pete and Jerry all the time I was there. This was 2 months of solitary confinement. I did see some Americans, though. But this is from my cell, looking down through the slats which supposedly covered the window. I talked to a couple of them, and one time the Frenchman came and opened the door and said it was défendu de parler. It was against the rules to talk. Got one haircut there. I tried to talk to the barber, and boy, they told me in no uncertain terms to shut up. Couldn't talk with them. And then after about 2 months, taken down to the chief's quarters, and there were three Gestapo agents, or men dressed in Gestapo uniform, the skull on their caps. We were taken to Toulouse from there, and placed into a large cell. It was a military prison, by the way. Great big cell. Must have been about 50 or 60 young men and boys in this situation. Spent several days and nights there, and we were told by one of the Frenchmen, who apparently had been there some time, that there were some French pilots in one of the other cells, and that one of these days we would be called out to go to Paris, taken to prison there, and maybe these French pilots would be there, but they were making keys for handcuffs. Sure enough, after a few days there, we were called out, and there were the French pilots, and we tried to get ourselves located. I think it was Pete and I, the Australian. Pete and I were handcuffed, of course, right behind the two Frenchmen. And Jerry and another guy, he was handcuffed to a German who had done something wrong. The Germans counted off people. Unfortunately, they stopped in front of us. And the next busload, Jerry, Pete and I and Jerry, of course, were placed in the next compartment in the train. I asked the German guard if we could be transferred into the compartment where our friends were. I meant where the Frenchmen were, but they said, nix. We rode up to Paris, got to Paris, got on the platform, they lined us up, all handcuffed together, two at a time. Germans were satisfied, and they marched up the steps and walked through the lobby of Gare du Nord, great big railroad station. It was like Grand Central Station. People all over the place. They were going through our ranks, and the Germans are raising the devil and trying to get the people out. We get outside, they line us up, and then there really was a flap. Two guys are missing, and of course the two fellows were the Frenchmen. Never did find them. We were taken to a prison outside of Paris. Now it's late at night, 9 or 10 o'clock. This is in June. In those latitudes, it's still bright or daylight at that hour. I remember passing Cathedral of Notre Dame, looked beautiful, but in our circumstances it wasn't so great. We were taken to this prison, and there I remember standing in the hallway. There was a German guard standing nearby, and I said to Pete, my God, is this going to be solitary confinement again? And this fellow said in good old American, no, I don't think so. I said, you're an American, aren't you? He said, yeah. What are you doing in a German uniform? Oh, he said, I was visiting here, and Germans wouldn't let me go home, wouldn't let me go back to the United States, so I had to join the Army. I called them all kinds of SOB for helping the Germans. Well, we were placed in solitary confinement. The next day, I was placed in a closet, I guess is all I can call it, like a locker. Spent all day in this thing, no food, no nothing, and it was awful. Could hardly stand up. In other words, it wasn't tall enough for a person to stand up. That was part of the softening up process, I guess. I was taken back to the cell, and the cell was barren. They had a metal cot, I guess you would call it, with a very thin mattress on it. You could feel every bit of it. There were like steel rods across, which meant, which were like a spring, but no spring to it at all. I could feel every one of them on my back. A chair, a little cup about the size of a coffee cup. There was running water, had a toilet, which was a luxury. I guess that was, oh, and a brush. That was about the extent of it. There was a handle on the brush, and I can remember I used to occupy my time with this brush. I'd take the wooden part of it and scrape the floor just to pass the time away. I tried to get some books. Eventually I got one. I read it forward and backward, and I swiped some of the pages in the middle and used as toilet paper. This is one thing that the French didn't, or Germans didn't use, I guess. And no toilet paper. You had to use your hands or whatever you could do. It was disgusting. After spending a month and a half or so at the prison, it's called Frayne Prison, I was taken down through the corridors, if you want to call them that, down into the dungeon, down the basement. And there were people lined up there. We were lined up in twos, taken out to a bus that was out there. It had little individual compartments. Taken to Gestapo headquarters in Paris. There were a lot of people there, and I remember being taken into this office, and a Gestapo agent questioning me about many things, and of course, I wouldn't give them the time of the day. Back to the prison. I noticed, though, however, that when I first, the first day I went out, there was a young girl, and she lined up with the rest of us. Second day, there she was, again. So I kind of sidled up next to her and said in my great French, vous êtes français? You are French? Oh, no, I'm Canadian. I said, what are you doing here? I was engaged in sending radio messages from Paris, and they've held me for questioning for over a year. What? Yeah, been here for over a year. But I have friends in Paris who send me food and stuff. I said, well, I'm starving to death. She said, well, if they take you out tomorrow, I'll have something for you. And again, I was taken to the Gestapo headquarters and talked to the man, whoever he was, and I wouldn't tell him yes, no, or maybe. Back to the cell. And I decided that night, he told me he wanted a story. And so I figure out a story. I describe all my grandparents and my uncles and aunts, but I decided I couldn't give descriptions of places because I was in a strange country and it was all new to me. Sure enough, next day, down to the dungeon again. There we are all lined up, and there's the girl. So I went up next to her and walked along with her, and she slipped me a package. In the package was a big, thick Spam sandwich and a chocolate bar. Well, I tell you, when I got into that van, I wolfed it down, went into the Gestapo headquarters. While I was sitting there, I noticed this girl was walking around freely, talking in German to the German guards. I thought to myself, uh-huh. You must be planted there to get information out of the people. I was taken into the office, and there I told the Gestapo agent a story. Well, he was delighted to get this information. In the meantime, there's a pack of cigarettes on his desk. I think I took practically all of them one at a time, took a couple of puffs, knocked off the end, stuck in my pocket. At the end of the interrogation, he said, how they treated you at the prison? I said, I'm starving to death. He said, well, we'll take care of that. Back to the prison I go. And they take me to another cell. Now, this cell was luxury in comparison to what I had before. This cell had a cot. Well, it was like a cot. Big, thick mattress, blanket, a mess kit. I said, what the devil's a mess kit for downstairs? I just had a bucket or a little can or something. I forget now. A teacup. Well, lunchtime came, and after you've been in a place for a while, you get used to the routine, and the fellows delivering the food went right past my cell door, and I thought, oh, my God, they've forgotten me. About a half hour later, I could hear the sounds of the trolley tracks. That's what they had all the way around this semicircular prison, and they carried the food in cans on top of this thing, on wheels. The thing stopped in front of my door and opened up, and the guy motioned to the mess kit. I handed it to him. He filled it up with potatoes, great big piece of bread, half a loaf of bread, a quarter of a pound of butter. Did I say hamburger? Well, there was a hamburger there, and potatoes. Oh, it was gorgeous. Well, of course, I wolfed it down, and not too long afterwards, I lost it. I realized then that I couldn't hold that stuff. I spent about a week or so in this new situation. It was great. The food was wonderful. I don't know whether fattening me up for the prison camp or what, but it was great. It was about July 3rd. Or fourth, I forget. It was a terrific air raid over Paris. I can remember yelling and cheering on the British, and I could see the bombs. Well, I couldn't see the bombs, but I could hear the explosions, and the lights were flashing. It was on July 5th, I think, that I was taken down to the office, and there were Pete and Jerry. We were being taken into Germany. We were put on a train. And they didn't handcuff us, but every night they take our shoes. We went into Frankfurt on the Main. There we were taken to a place called Dulagluf. Again, solitary confinement. It was like a camp, I guess you might call it. Place in solitary confinement and more interrogation. Of course, I told them I had told a story at Frayne Prison, and I had nothing new to add. Then I was let out, and there were Americans and British, and it was great. We were on our own. They gave us food parcels. I hadn't seen that much food since I had left the base. In fact, didn't have that much food at the base, seemed to me. We spent several days there. I forget how long. We were placed on trains again. This time, it was a long ride to a place called Sagen, 90 miles southeast of Berlin. This was the prison camp that I would spend a considerable amount of time. I think we arrived there sometime in July, late July, or early August. and didn't. Now this is August of 1943. We didn't leave there until January of 1945. And so that was a long stretch there. We were taken into the camp, and it was a great big place called the Center Camp, or house place. Mostly Americans, practically all Americans there, some British. But the Center Camp, and I think it was the East Camp, were joined. In other words, it could go back and forth. The British contained or stayed in the East Camp, but they came over into the Center Camp and mingled with the Americans, and it was a pretty good situation. Now, this is hot summer. God, it was hot. And while I was there, I heard somebody talking about a new camp that many of the Americans had been sent to right across the way. It was called the South Camp. And so the name Berman was mentioned. Now, Hank Berman was my pilot. I thought, it can't be possible that Hank Berman survived the crash, because I didn't see any parachutes after I got out. Well, there came a time in September when we were asked if we wanted to be transferred to the American camp, South Camp. And I said, sure, I'd like to go over there. And so I was one who was taken to the South Camp. And as I approached the gate, there, big as life, is Hank Berman. Now, Hank Berman's about 6'4". Couldn't miss him. Well, I said to him, I thought you were dead. And he said the same thing to me. I thought you were dead. He said, come on. He said, you can stay with us in our room. Apparently there was a group of fellows in the rooms, and Hank welcomed me into his room with all these other guys. There were bunk beds around the place. I forget how many were there now. I can remember Chow Jean, a fellow who was back at the base with us. He was a bombardier. He was the only one who got out of his plane. And then there were some other fellows. What their names are now escape me. But I spent a long time there, and we did various things, tried escape activities, or at least helped with the escape activities. Fellows were always trying to get out. We were digging tunnels and making things for the fellows who were escaping, trying to save food in the event we had an emergency, which did happen a year and a half later, but I'll get to that at a later time. There were many things that happened in camp, so many that I'm not going to spend any great amount of time reiterating them, but one of the most tragic periods occurred on my birthday, April 9th. 1944, Hookhouse was shot by a German. An air raid sounded, and there were no planes in the air. We hadn't seen the airplanes all the time we were there. And apparently this German guard had a light finger or something and shot from a considerable distance and hit this poor fellow standing in the doorway, hit him right in the head, killed him. The only GI, minding his own business. That was the end of the war for him, poor devil. German claimed that he was signaling, this fellow was signaling the airplanes overhead. As I said before, there were no airplanes. Other things happened. Sometimes a fellow would steal something from the Germans, and they would line us up outside on the parade grounds and keep us there for hours on end, trying to get the stuff, whatever it was. And sometimes in the middle of summer, stand out in the hot sun for hours. It wasn't very pleasant. And also, during the night, they'd come in, have a quick search, line us up, freezing cold, or depending upon the season. I just like those night searches because they did that during the winter time. Well, to push things forward, one night, we could hear rumblings or like guns being fired. It was the Russians coming. This is in January 1945. It was snowing like mad. Germans came in, I forget the exact date now, late January, informed us that we had to get out in half an hour. Remember earlier I said we had to try to save some food? Well, we did. We packed whatever food we had, and we teamed up. We had buddies. And it was snowing. It was cold. I'm telling you, it was terrible. And so about midnight, we started the march. It was like an evacuation of a city or town all the way along the line. After a while, fellows were throwing stuff away. They tried to carry too much. Remember, we'd been cooped up for 2 years or more. And the fellows weren't ready for this heavy physical activity. We could walk around the perimeter inside our camp, but to walk for several hours on end without stopping, this is against all the rules. You're supposed to walk 50 minutes, stop, rest for 10. No way. On and on we walked. Finally, we came to a large autobahn, and it was cold. The wind was whipping down this place. I had a blog, a book, which I kept, an account of our activities. Well, I figured that was too heavy, and so I burned it to keep warm. We walked all that night. Finally, we came to a great big farm, and there the Germans told us to fend for ourselves. We had to go where we could find shelter. Now, this is daylight. We've been walking all night. I went down to the cow area. It was warm down there, a lot of cows, and their bodies exuded heat. And I spent all day down there. Couldn't sleep very well. And then about dusk, again, the Germans told us to get on our way. And so we trudged down the roads and through the darkness. And I can remember a great big hill we went up. God, it was long. There were fellows dropping all over the place. Even the German guards who were walking alongside of us had difficulty. Some of the fellows were carrying their guns. I told the guide, I said, "You're nuts. I wouldn't carry anything for them." Well, we walked into a town where there was a glass factory. Now, the glass factory was in operation. There was heat in this place. And so we were led into this place, and we found a room that was so warm. And couldn't spend too much time in there because we weren't used to that kind of heat. We'd been out in the cold so long. I remember we started a fire out in the area that was out there. And I got my feet too close to the fire. I tried to get my shoes dried, and if you lose your shoes, you're in trouble because you can't get another pair of shoes. And mine were pretty badly scarred up. Well, I took care of that. I got away from the fire and tried to make myself as comfortable as possible. And so we spent that night there, or a good portion of that night. Next morning, the Germans tried to get us to go out. And previously, the colonel, who was our leader, said, "You fellas want to march in the morning? Nothing doing. Okay. When the Germans come in, I'll tell them." Well, the Germans were so angry, we refused to move. And so we spent all that day resting. And the next day, we started out. And the pace was so slow. It was unbelievable. We walked all that day and came. And we approached a small town. It was just about dusk. And again, the Germans said, "Go into any of these houses you want to, or try to get into any of these houses. Spend the night there." Well, luckily, I found a house that was fairly comfortable. And I remember trading cigarettes for some apples. And they tasted so good. Spent the night in their barn there. Next morning early, we were taken out. And we were taken to a large military installation, which was nearby. Spent a good part of the day inside this, like a great big gymnasium. And there, finally, we were taken to the railroad yards. And now we have an experience which is not too pleasant. We were stuffed into these railroad cars, about 60 of us, which were only supposed to hold 30 men. The old French cars, 6 or 8 horses and 30 men or whatever it was. We spent several days and nights in these freight cars. And I'll tell you, it was awful being in those cattle cars. We spent 3 days and at least 3 nights in those things. They opened the doors of the cattle cars once. We had to go out and do our duty. In the meantime, one of the fellows had one of the hacksaws in his possession and cut a hole in the bottom of the freight car so that those fellows who wanted to do their duty could, but the smell in the place was awful. They gave us some meat at one stop, but it certainly wasn't enough for us. On the third or fourth night, we stopped at a place, and it was Mooseburg. That was our destination. They took us off the cars and took us to it was a prison camp, really. And there we were told to leave our stuff outside of the washroom. We could go inside and take a hot shower. And we did leave our stuff outside, went in. I remember spending an awful lot of time in the steam room. Well, it wasn't a steam room, it was a shower, and it was steamy, and took a good hot shower. When I went outside to get my stuff, all the good stuff was gone. Either the French or the Russian prisoners or somebody had stolen all our food and whatever they could use for trading. They took us to the prison camp itself, and it was pretty bad. The barracks were old. They had used them in World War I, apparently. Of course, there were bugs and God knows what all in the mattresses, the straw. I elected to sleep on the floor, which I got accustomed to doing. Didn't sleep very well anyway. As a matter of fact, when I got home, it was a long time before I could sleep in the bed. I had to get out of bed and sleep on the floor. I remember my mother wondered why I was doing that, and I explained to her why it was perfectly okay. While we were there, I was taken out for promenade. Well, I guess you might say taken out for a walk with some other fellows. This would be the second time that I had been taken out of the prison camp. I forgot to mention it, that when I was up in Sagan, I was taken out once for a walk around the area, and it was good to get out, but always glad to get back to prison camp because we weren't used to that kind of distance walking, continuously at any rate. As we were walking around, on our way back, a wagon came by piled high with potatoes, driven by an old German farmer. And so we helped ourselves to the potatoes. They were covered with crud. Didn't know what it was at the time. I know I brushed mine off well I could, and I started to eat. I ate some of it raw. That was a mistake. As a result of it, I got diarrhea, dysentery. Call it whatever you want, but it was horrible. And the reason why I got it, because these potatoes had been cultivated with human excrement. And apparently the excrement was still on the potato. I hadn't cleaned it well enough, and it got into my system, and oh, God. It was awful. I had to go to the bathroom time after time after time, bleeding. This stayed with me for a long time. As a matter of fact, it delayed my getting out of the service. I remember going to Fort Dix, staying there until I was sure that it had cleared. Stayed there at Mooseburg for some time. Meantime, the Russians were coming in. The fellows used my bunk as a listening post for the wireless, the Morse code. We got messages that the Russians were coming in. And no, it wasn't the Russians. Pardon me. The Americans were coming. We could hear the guns firing, the rumbling. Could put your ear down to the ground and hear the ground shaking, vibrating from tanks, I guess, and large vehicles. And finally, latter part of April. Oh, also, at that time we heard about President Roosevelt's death. Of course, this sadness, but the war was drawing to a close. Finally, one bright morning, I could hear some firing. I remember running to a slit trench. I figured I'd gone all this time. I wasn't about to get hit by a stray bullet. Some of the fellows were crazy and went on top of the barracks to watch the action. Actually, wasn't much to see. There was a church steeple we could see in the distance from our camp. And suddenly there was an American flag flying there. And I thought, by God, the war is over for us at this time. In the meantime, a big tank came through the barbed wire, and I remember the fellows climbing all over and exclaiming where the men were there. After a few hours, General Patton himself came in. I was surprised to see him because he wasn't what I expected. He was much older. His voice had that high-pitched old person's sound, and he questioned us about the conditions and so on, and they were pretty poor at the time. Many of us were living in tents. I say I was sleeping on the floor. I remember I had a little makeshift stove on which I tried to cook some food for my buddy and me. But actually, General Patton cried because it was so bad and it affected him. So he was a good man. The Americans left us after liberating us. The Germans were all gone and captured. We had nothing. We had to be on our own. And now we had to get our own food. Some of the fellows went into the little town nearby and liberated some stuff. Another fellow and I decided to go in and see what we could get. We didn't get anything. After 3 or 4 days, the weather turned bad. We were supposed to go out right away. C-47s were supposed to come in, pick us up, and take us to Le Havre, where we would be at a camp called RAMP, R-A-M-P, Recovered Allied Military Personnel Camp. There they would take care of us, fatten us up, put us on a ship, send us back to the United States. The weather socked in, and we couldn't get up. And now things are getting tough because they don't have any food coming in. Finally, one day, the weather broke, and some big trucks came in and delivered some food for us. I can remember that bread that we got, white bread. My God, it was so good. Tasted like cake. Had never tasted anything so good in all my life. After a day or two, we were finally picked up by the trucks and taken to a place called Landshut. We had to wait there for some time. A lot of planes came in, say the C-47s. They did a good job getting us lined up, and we flew out. And I remember the pilot, as we were approaching Paris, he said he was going to fly down low and circle around so we could see what it looked like. Well, of course, I had seen a little bit of it from the ground, and it was beautiful, beautiful sight. Got into Le Havre and went to this camp that I mentioned earlier, and they had kitchens all over the place, and you could get anything you wanted anytime. I remember going so many times for malted milk and sandwiches and so on. The fellows who were operating the kitchens were Italian prisoners. Yeah, all you had to do was say encore. That meant more, if you wanted more. And you could eat as many times a day as you wanted. We had to sleep in tents there, but it wasn't bad. I can remember walking out to a bluff and looking out over Le Havre, and it had been blasted by our bombers. It was pretty well broken up. There were ships there. I think I spent a week or 10 days at Le Havre. Finally, I was put on a ship and given $80, American money. Got on a ship, assigned a room, and I found a crap game going. And in a matter of minutes, my $80 was gone. Here I am. I got a whole ocean to cross, no money. The only money I would need would be to buy cigarettes. Well, I borrowed some from a friend, and we stayed together. As a matter of fact, we went to Atlantic City for recuperation together. He lived in the city, and I met him, and he had a car, and we drove to Atlantic City. But in the meantime, on our way across the Atlantic, it ran to a storm. It was terrible. God almighty. This ship went up on these huge waves and then goes sliding down, and the waves would come right over top of the ship, and thing in the back that the propellers would be churning around, and you hear this awful crash. You think the thing's going to sink. Many of the fellows got seasick. I was on the verge of it, but it never happened. We were fed twice a day, got enough to eat, but it was a long, dull voyage. I can remember going into New York Harbor, and when I saw that Statue of Liberty, I think I cried. Matter of fact, I choke up now when I think about it, but, as we went in, there were some ships coming toward us. There were a lot of young girls on the ships waving at us and saying, welcome back, welcome back. We got into New York and got off the ship. There were Red Cross workers down at the bottom. They handed us some cigarettes, which were always welcome. And I think we got a cup of coffee, too. We had to wait there for a while. Take a train to a place in, trying to think of the name of the camp in New Jersey. Camp Kilmer. At Camp Kilmer. Didn't get there until late at night. And I remember they had not the cafeteria. They had the mess hall open. And, oh, they had all kinds of food there. I can remember having a great big steak. But they murdered it. It had some kind of rotten stuff on it. Didn't taste so good. Then I remember calling home, and, oh, I was so delighted to talk with the folks, and I told them I'd be home sometime the next day. Next day I was taken into, went into New York, and I can remember going to a barbershop there. I had a carton of cigarettes in my hand. I got a haircut and a manicure. And I can remember at the end giving the girl the money, and she's, and a tip. She said, I would rather have a pack of cigarettes if you could afford it. I said, sure, take a pack. She said, you don't know what you're doing. It's very hard to get cigarettes. I said, take the pack. Got on a train, got up the Peekskill, and the folks were waiting. And that was the end of the trail. I got to go back and tell you about some of the things that I left out. When Jerry and I were going from one underground situation to the other, we had a rummy game we played called 500 Rummy. And I kept the score. I had a column, three names, and I kept the figures. And I kept the sheets. There were figures all over these sheets. When we were captured by the French, of course, they took these, they took everything from us, and these sheets were part of it. And I can remember when I was in the detective's office, there was one man going over these sheets. So the fellow who was interrogating me got the sheets and came over and he said, what are these? And I explained to him that they were just scores that I kept as a result of a game. He said, no. This is code. And I laughed. I think they're still working on the code. Another thing that I did that I forgot to say, when I was in the French prison in Fresnes, a prison outside of Paris, I communicated with a guy next to my cell by Morse code, but I did this, or we did this, by kicking the wall. One kick would be a dot, and two knocks would be dash. And we communicated in the fashion. I found out that he was French, and he learned I was American, and we had a little bit of, well, it was something to do. Also, when I was back in the prison at Fresnes, when I took, Castres, I didn't mention that in one of the courtyards there was a workshop that one of the fellows that the French had, and I reached in and picked out a piece of wood from one of the windows, and from this piece of wood I carved a gun, something that looked like a gun. My plan was to try to get down to the chief's office and whip out this gun, and the element of surprise, of course I could get a real gun and escape out the door. Well, that was a crazy idea because I never got close to, chief. While in prison camp, there are all kinds of escape activities, and we had tunnels going. We had fellows called stooges. I was a stooge. The center camp where I first went, they asked me if I wanted to participate in escape. I said, sure. They were digging a tunnel from the latrine out under the barbed wire, which was about maybe 40 feet away, and they were going to get maybe 40 or 50 fellows out. Would I participate? I said, sure. And so they had the tunnel pretty well dug. But unfortunately, this tunnel went under a road, and the Germans had big trucks and wagons going back and forth across the road. I think they suspected that was there. And one day it collapsed. The role of the stooge was to watch and see if the Germans were coming, and to give the signal to the fellows who were digging. They would stop. All activity would stop, and then after the Germans left the area, then they would continue. Another problem was getting rid of the sand. What they did was mix the sand with the ashes from the fireplaces, but you couldn't get rid of much there. A good bit of sand was also hidden or placed up in the attic of the barracks. Also, the sand was mixed in thrown into the fire pool. After a while, the fire pool, which was supposed to be, in case they had a fire, they'd take the water out of the fire pool and shoot on the fire, it was filled up with sand. Another way was to mix the sand with the ground outside. It was very difficult. Another plan, and it worked. We claimed that the latrine from the barracks out, the night latrine, was clogged. And so the Germans loaned us shovels and picks, and we opened up the big hole to try to fix the plumbing. And while we were doing that, we were throwing sand into it. Good way to get rid of sand. We got rid of a lot of sand in that fashion. I'm jumping all over, but I'm sticking in things as I think about them.